The Guardian.
Hello, this is Science Weekly. I'm Alok Jha. On this week's podcast...
Think of our universe as an expanding bubble in a big cosmic bubble bath where the other bubbles are other universes coming from other Big Bangs.
You're now entering a parallel universe.
The universe, in its earliest moments, was filled with a kind of energy that gave rise to some repulsive gravity. Repulsive, not attractive gravity. Strange idea. And that repulsive gravity drove everything apart.
Brian Green explains how everything fits together.
Have you ever met a dog or a cat that understands the general theory of relativity? I don't think so. I mean, every time I say that, I just imagine these dogs and cats all laughing at me. Ah, he thinks we don't know general relativity. But let's just take it as a given that they don't understand general relativity because they don't have the brain power.
Plus, Guardian readers get to grill a controversial professor who says the only way to save the environment is to ditch consumerism.
Governments have a role to protect economic stability. So in some senses, they're doing their job. But in other senses, they're not, because we still haven't solved the problem that economic growth can't go on forever.
Tim Jackson says quick fixes and short-termism need to stop right now.
Better health, more food, longer lives. The poorest nations in the world desperately need those kinds of advances, but that doesn't get us off the hook.
This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. Welcome back. We've just about recovered from our whistle-stop tour of Germany, and we're now back in the studio. I'm technically on holiday.
Shall I wear headphones? Does it matter?
No, you don't need to.
Yeah, go on.
Oh, okay. This week, a more straightforward show. Simples. It's just me and Brian Green.
It's a subconscious thing that stops him drifting away from the microphone.
Oh, I see.
It feels like you're in showbiz with those on, you see.
I'm Brian Green, professor of physics and mathematics at Columbia University.
Now, Brian clearly likes challenges.
I'm actually getting a slightly strange. Can I adjust volume? Oh, good. That's much better.
He's a big popularizer of theoretical physics.
Yes.
You may have heard of his previous book, Fabric of the Cosmos, all about string theory.
My new book is called The Hidden Reality and explores the possibility that our universe may not be the only universe.
Brian, your book is about multiverse theory, which is very sexy in physics nowadays. Everyone's sort of on this. Martin Rees, the former president of the Royal Society, you know, gave it his backing a while ago. People are writing all sorts of books about it. Michio Kaku had a book a while ago. Multiverse theory might be popular now, but it hasn't always been popular amongst physicists. Can you just take us a bit through the background? When did it start to be taken seriously?
Well, the very first scientific proposal in at least the modern era that our universe might be one of many universes happened in 1957. A graduate student at Princeton University in the United States named Hugh Everett, who is studying quantum physics, found that if you took the math of quantum physics very seriously, the math was pointing toward there being multiple realities where each of the possible outcomes allowed by the quantum laws would be realized in one or another universe. This was not a popular proposal. It did not catch on at the time. It really died away for many years and has only slowly gone through a renaissance. What is rather remarkable is that's just the first proposal. The book, The Hidden Reality, that I'm describing here, discusses 9 possible variations on the theme of multiverse proposals that come from a variety of different mathematical explorations, all tied toward trying to understand the deep laws of the universe.
There are many, many ideas of how these universes might be arranged, set up, how they might have formed. We don't know which one is actually correct. The one you just mentioned, the quantum mechanical description, the many worlds hypothesis, just take us through what that is for anyone who's never heard of it.
Well, the new idea of quantum physics is that you cannot predict with absolute certainty the result of any experiment. That was the Newtonian image. You tell me how things are right now, I'll use the mathematics to predict how they will be in 5 minutes or an hour or a year later. Quantum mechanics came along and said, that's an approximation. The true description of reality is you tell me how things are now, and I will predict the probability that things will turn out one way or another way still. For instance, if I'm discussing the motion of an electron, I might be able to say there's a 50% chance that the electron is over here and a 50% chance that it's over there. And that's the best you can do according to the quantum laws. Now, here is the weirdness. When you perform a measurement on the electron, you find it at one location or another. You find it either here or there. So the question is, what happens to the other possible outcome when you find it at one location? The answer, according to this particular approach, this multi-world approach to quantum mechanics, is that each outcome does happen. There is a version of you that sees the electron in one location and another version of you that sees the electron at the other location. Two realities arise, each with a version of you who thinks there's a single reality, but from the bird's eye view, we see that you are wrong. There are two of you seeing each of those possible outcomes. Multiple universes coming from the laws of quantum physics.
So every decision point creates a new universe.
Yes, that's exactly the point. You know, when you talk about an electron here or there, it's not that fascinating. But if you realize that every decision that you make amounts to your particles going one way or another, then we are saying, at least in this idea, that every possible outcome, every decision that you have come upon in your life, all of the possible decisions were actually realized, even though you didn't know that, each in its own separate reality.
There's something quite cosmologically profound about thinking that just taking one bus rather than another, you create several trillion new universes straight away.
Exactly. Now, when phrased that way, it sounds enormously extravagant. All of these universes being created and created, the thing that needs to be emphasized is, from the mathematical standpoint, this is the most economical, the most conservative way of interpreting the mathematics of quantum mechanics, math that has proven itself able to describe the results of experiments. This is something that yields a very rich outcome, like Darwinian evolution. Simple idea, rich natural world filled with all sorts of life. But the ideas are simple that underlie it. Similarly, rich spectrum of universes, but the quantum math that underlies it is very straightforward. That doesn't mean it's right, but it does mean that this is not as extravagant as it may seem.
I'm not sure quantum mathematics is very simple, but let's move on to another example of the multiverses. So there are nine. I mean, we probably won't go through all of them, but let me go through some of the ones I find most interesting. Brain multiverses. This is an expression of string theory, which we've discussed several times before. Another highly theoretical subject, which is an attempt to unify quantum mechanics with general relativity, the sort of the physics of the very, very big with the physics of the very, very small. And it's a very successful theory, mathematically at least. And brain multiverses come out of that. Just tell us a bit about that.
Yeah, so brain here is B-R-A-N-E. It comes from the word membrane. And the idea from string theory is that all that we know about every star, every galaxy may reside on a giant membrane, a giant sheet of space, if you will. Now, it's actually a three-dimensional sheet. It's easier to picture using two-dimensional visualization. So think of a huge slice of bread and imagine that our universe exists just on that slice of bread. That slice of bread would be called a membrane universe, or a brain universe for short. And the math of string theory shows that there's every possibility that there are other universes on other slices of bread, other membranes, other brain universes out there. Collectively, all these slices would be part of a giant cosmic loaf, universe upon universe upon universe. Some of these brain universes, the others might be a millimeter away, right next to us. Why wouldn't we see them? Well, light, it turns out, according to the math, can't jump the gap between one of these pieces of bread and another, making all of the others invisible to us. But it's not impossible that other things can jump the gap, allowing us to test this.
Well, what kind of things might be able to do that?
Well, gravity is a force that we believe can jump the gap. And what that means is, at the Large Hadron Collider in Geneva, Switzerland, there's a chance of testing this idea. When you slam two protons together at fantastically high speed, some of the debris created in the collisions would be gravitons, little tiny particles of gravity. Those little pieces of debris can jump off of our brain, our slice of bread, into the wider expanse. If that happens, how would we know it? Well, the debris would take away some energy with it, which means our detectors on our brain, our universe, would see less energy after the collision than before. A missing energy signature that people at CERN are now looking for, have not found it yet. But this, if it's found, could be evidence that we're living on a giant membrane, that there might be other membrane universes out there.
If gravitons are going between one brain and the other, does the math then allow that to explain why gravity is, in our experience, weaker than the other forces, other fundamental forces, so much weaker?
Absolutely. So one of the ideas for why gravity is so weak, and just in case everybody's not fully familiar with that idea, I mean, gravity seems sort of strong. It's a dominant
keeps
force in the world around
the ground,
us. But think about it. You know, when you lift up your coffee cup, as you just did, as you lifted it off your table, your muscles in your arm were able to overcome the entire pull of the Earth's gravity. You beat out the Earth with your bicep. That is because gravity is actually not that strong. It's just that you've got a big Earth underneath, which makes its force apparent. So why is it that gravity is relatively weak? One possibility is that gravity leaks off of our universe in the way that we were describing. It leaks off of our slice of bread, our brain universe, and because it leaks away into the wider expanse, it dilutes and therefore is less strong in its ability to affect us. That is an idea that people have been developing for some time now.
Could this be used perhaps to detect other brains?
Yes, yes. I mean, if we were able to eject gravity willfully, volitionally, at the Large Hadron Collider, as I was describing, that would be a test at least that we're on a brain. What could also happen is we could experience the gravity that comes from one of these other nearby universes. So people have suggested, although I don't think fully successfully yet, that the dark matter, no doubt you've heard of the fact that we believe that there is matter in space that exerts gravity that we don't see. We don't see, so we call it dark. Maybe the reason we don't see it, some suggest, is that this matter is actually on one of these nearby universes. We don't see it because light can't jump the gap, but we can feel the gravity because gravity can jump the gap. Maybe that's the explanation. I don't think this quite works, but it would be an example of what you're saying, where we are feeling the gravity from another universe.
That's incredibly neat, isn't it, as an explanation. And also doesn't mean you have to come up with all sorts of new particles for the standard model.
That's right.
Okay, well, let's move on to another one. Inflationary multiverses. This is something that were created perhaps right at the beginning of the universe.
Yes. The idea comes from the Big Bang theory that most of us have some familiarity with, which is a theory that talks about the origin and evolution of the universe. And one of the key features of the Big Bang that perhaps we haven't emphasized enough in our public discourse is that it leaves out something very, very important. The Big Bang does not tell us what happened at the beginning. What was that bang? What caused the outward swelling of space? And we've been struggling to fill in this gap for a while, and the inflationary approach that you mentioned is our best guess as to what happened. And the idea is that the universe in its earliest moments was filled with a kind of energy that gave rise to some repulsive gravity. Repulsive, not attractive gravity. Strange idea. And that repulsive gravity drove everything apart. Now, the reason why this is relevant for our story here of other universes is for the reason that you alluded to. When we study the math of this inflationary approach, it seems to suggest that the Big Bang, this outward swelling from repulsive gravity, was not a one-time event, not a unique event. There may be many Big Bangs, many outward swellings, each giving rise to its own expanding domain, our universe. Everything that we see would be the result of only one Big Bang. Other universes would arise from the other Big Bangs. An image to have in mind is, think of our universe as an expanding bubble in a big cosmic bubble bath, where the other bubbles are other universes coming from other Big Bangs.
I mean, inflation, relatively speaking, is a fairly new idea in cosmology.
Yes.
One which is accepted now, but the implications are kind of profound and a bit strange. I mean, it's saying that in our universe, I mean, some of the interpretations say that in our universe, because of inflation, different bits of it might follow slightly different rules, slightly different laws of physics. I mean, does that kind of correlate with the multiverse idea?
Yes. I think a good way to think about it would be that the other universes from the other Big Bangs in the inflationary setup would indeed have the capacity to follow slightly different rules or have slightly different physical features, because their environment, their historical development would in general differ from ours because it's at a different location, formed at a different time, and so forth. And that would mean that the kinds of particles there might be somewhat different. The strengths of the forces might be somewhat different. The detailed features of that physical realm could differ significantly from ours, so much so that there might not be stars and galaxies there. There, therefore, might not be planets and people there. We may live in this particular domain because we simply could never evolve or survive in the other universes. And that may be an explanation for why we see things the way that they currently are.
Slightly more prosaically, perhaps, although I'm sure none of this is really very prosaic, is what you call quilted universes. Now, this is the idea that our space extends infinitely far. And if you go far enough from where you are, you'll find an exact copy of yourself just by statistics alone, which sounds remarkable, but math says it has to be true.
Yeah, it's a startling idea that comes from the simplest of considerations. You're absolutely right. So we don't know, first of all, if space does go on infinitely far. If you got into a spaceship, would you go out for a while, travel, and hit the end of the universe, a brick wall? Possible, but that doesn't seem to be a compelling thing in terms of how the universe is set up. Would you go on for a while and circle back to your starting point like Francis Drake did on the surface of the Earth? Maybe, it's a possibility. But you might simply go on forever. Let's take that possibility seriously, as many physicists over many years have. How do you get to the conclusion that you were alluding to? Well, think about it like this. In any finite region of space, matter can only be arranged in finitely many different configurations. Sort of like I like to use a deck of cards as an analogy. Shuffle the deck, the cards come out different orders. Shuffle again, you'll get a different order. But there are only finitely many different orders for the cards, which means if you shuffle the deck enough times, the order of the cards has to repeat. If you shuffle the deck infinitely many times, you are guaranteed that it will repeat many, many times. Similarly, in an infinite universe, the order of the particles region by region sooner or later has to repeat too, for exactly the same reason. There aren't enough different orders to go around, sooner or later has to repeat. Now, what does that mean? Well, you, me, the Earth, we are all just a configuration of particles in one arrangement. If this arrangement of particles repeats out there, then you are out there, I am out there, the Earth is out there, there are copies of us out there.
Now, can you work out how far?
Yes, you can work out statistically how far. It's about 10 to the 10 to the 120 meters.
So not reachable.
Not reachable, that's very far, because there are many ways, even though it's finite in number, there are many ways the particles can arrange themselves. But in an infinite universe, 10 to the 10 to 120 meters is very small compared to infinity. So it would be out there.
The other reason, I suppose, you couldn't reach it is space is expanding. So it's expanding faster than you could ever travel.
Yes, in any practical sense, we can't go and visit our duplicate out there. So while the math would establish this under the assumption that space goes on infinitely far, and the other hidden assumption, we're assuming that the laws that we know about here are the same laws way out there in space. Everything suggests that, but who knows? Maybe that's not correct. But under those two assumptions, the conclusion that we are out there is unassailable.
Now, all of this stuff, as you say, is theoretical, and there's some incredibly creative stuff out there coming from physicists. And I mean, a lot of it, which kind of, even for anyone who sort of is logical in their minds, would find it hard to believe or understand, because it's quite mathematical, I suppose. That's where it's coming from. And your book is quite clear about saying that it's coming out of the maths. It's not just an idea I've got, which I'm trying to prove. And I just wonder, how far can you go with the maths? I mean, maths is a description of abstraction, but physics has to be about reality. So how far can maths push you?
It's very hard to know. I mean, Einstein himself made the wrong judgment on which mathematics would describe reality and which wouldn't. Even his own equations from his general theory of relativity, his theory of gravity developed in the early part of the 20th century, when the math of those equations said the universe should be expanding, Einstein said, no, I don't believe it. You know, you look up, the stars aren't all rapidly moving through space. The universe is not changing. It's static and eternal. 12 years later, Edwin Hubble looks at the distant galaxies and finds that the universe is expanding. And Einstein kind of smacks himself in the head and says, why didn't I trust the mathematics? So even Einstein wasn't always right in judging which math describes reality and which doesn't. But what we are doing here, and just to emphasize the very critical point that you made, we are following the same trajectory that Newton, Maxwell, Einstein, all the great physicists lay down as the strategy for revealing aspects of nature of reality that we can't yet see. Follow the math and see where it takes you. So we are not sitting in our room saying, wouldn't it be remarkable if there are other universes? Let's see if we can force this into a mathematical theory. No, we are following the mathematics that has been developed to describe the things that we can see, quantum mechanics, general relativity, and so forth. And we're saying, let's push the math and see where it takes us. And it has taken us to this possibility of other universes. And that's why we take the idea seriously.
Every time.
Sorry. I've completely forgot to switch this off.
So unprofessional. Apologies, Brian.
That's okay.
Terrible. I will scold him afterwards.
Hang on. I didn't even know this was on. I'm sorry. Hang on. Let me switch it off right now.
But it's very comforting to know that there is a parallel universe where you did shut that off.
I did, didn't I?
So we were guaranteed for that to happen in some universe since it's compatible
probably
with the laws
of
physics. Probably
an infinite number of parallel universes where I switched that off. This is just the one. This is the think how lucky you are that you're in the rare one. Where
that is, you know.
I'm now leaving that in now.
Okay. There's another question I have with, for example, the many worlds hypothesis. If new universes are being created every time someone makes a decision, where is the energy coming from to create these universes?
Well, energy conservation is a very interesting and subtle concept in physics. What we really know is that in any local region, energy would be conserved in the sense that any energy that's lost in that region must have left it, must have drifted outside. Any increase of energy in that region must have come in from the outside. But when it comes to applying that idea to the entire universe, it is a thorny subject. For instance, even in a single universe like ours, we do not have a notion of global total energy conservation across the entire universe. It's very hard to even define what you mean by the entire universe's energy. So the real way to think about energy conservation is in the more prosaic sense. You're in your laboratory, you're doing an experiment, and the energy that you start with should be the energy that you end up with there. But in terms of applying it across even a single universe and then multiple universes, this is an idea where that notion does not directly apply.
So it's a bit like saying that the laws of physics are a bit uncertain at those sorts of scales.
I wouldn't even say uncertain per se. It's very difficult to define what you mean by total energy when you're applying it to an entire universe because you can't stand outside of it and measure it. So that reflects itself in the mathematics, which is somewhat equivocal, not in terms of energy conservation in a localized region, but yes, when it applies to the entire universe.
Now, one day you're going to have to step back from the mathematics and actually test some of this stuff. I mean, what kinds of experiments are possible for any of these types of universe?
Well, the inflationary multiverse, the one that we were talking about with the multiple Big Bangs, I think provides a good case study. Because normally you'd say, well, look, if it's another universe, we'll never be able to access it or see it. All we can ever possibly access is this universe. But that's not necessarily true. If you imagine you've got expanding bubble universes, this cosmic bubble bath imagery that I mentioned before, you can imagine that two of those bubbles can collide. Our universe, in principle, can get hit by one of those other universes. How would we know that? Well, if it's a glancing blow, sort of a fender bender with another universe, that impact can generate ripples that will go through the cosmic microwave background radiation. This is heat that's all around us that's left over from the Big Bang in our universe. The impact from another universe would imprint tiny temperature differences in a very specific pattern in this microwave background radiation that we can and are looking for. We've not seen evidence yet, but that gives you a concrete way in which another universe can yield something observable in our universe, at least in principle.
And is that similar for the other ideas as well? Are there practical, semi-practical experiments that one could do?
Not all of them. And I'd say each multiverse proposal comes with its own particular way in which it may make contact with observations. The possibility of space going infinitely far, which was the assumption under the idea of there being copies of you and me out there in space. How would you test that one? Well, the easiest way to test that one would be the negative, to try to show that space is not infinitely big. How would you show that? Well, if space is finite, well, like the surface of the Earth, if a distant galaxy is giving off light, some of it may enter our eyes, but some of that light would pass by us, circle around the entire universe, and enter our eyes a second time. So we should see multiple images of a single object in the sky. Astronomers have looked for these multiple images. If they were to find them, that would be evidence that space is finite. Rule out that multiverse that we were discussing. No such evidence yet, but this is a way in which, at least in principle, this idea could be falsified.
Is it hubristic to think that we're going to be able to understand this? Because this is something, it's not like watching a ball fly up in the air or working out gravity, which I know it sounds silly to say that it's simple, but it's in our cosmos. It's something that we can see and measure. Something like this is something outside our experience, and it's possibly something we can never measure. How likely is it that we'll ever be able to understand this stuff?
Well, I think from a number of perspectives, one has to have a certain degree of humility when talking about these big ideas. I mean, look around planet Earth, there are some very intelligent beings on planet Earth that don't understand, for instance, general relativity. And I'm not talking about humans who haven't studied it. They have the capacity to understand it. They just haven't applied themselves. I'm talking about dogs and cats. Have you ever met a dog or a cat that understands the general theory of relativity? I don't think so. I mean, every time I say that, I just imagine these dogs and cats all laughing at me. Ah, he thinks we don't know general relativity. But let's just take it as a given that they don't understand general relativity because they don't have the brain power. So they are limited in what they can understand about reality. We may be in a similar boat. Wouldn't that be awful? It could be the case, right? I mean, why would it be the case that this gray matter inside our head is able to understand the ultimate reality, the ultimate truths about the universe? So we may never understand it all simply because of our limited intellectual powers. However, having said that, what we have seen is that as we apply ourselves ever more diligently to problems that we are facing, we are able to make progress. We've not hit the wall, at least not yet. And as our math takes us to these vast realms, these pictures of this vast cosmos that may have many, many universes, we take that idea seriously and push on and see where it will lead. So to my mind, it's just thrilling that we little puny beings on the surface of this nondescript planet orbiting this average star may, through the power of thought, observation, and experiment, be able to reach out so far beyond the confines of where our physical being lies. Maybe we will understand much about the universe. Maybe we will understand these other universes, but you're right. We may be limited.
Multiverse theory, in some respects, is kind of like physicists having their cake, eating it, going back to the bakery, having another one, eating that one too, and then going maybe for a third, because it's like their argument seems to be, well, you know, God didn't create the universe, but actually everything is possible. It's, we can't tell you what happened, but we're going to instead tell you everything is possible. So it's not really an answer at all.
Well, if we were actually saying everything and anything is possible, then you'd be right. But we're not saying that at all. What we're saying is there are some very specific, very constraining mathematical laws that do not allow everything to happen. And within the straitjacket of those mathematical laws, we're describing what can happen. And what can happen, according to the mathematics, may be somewhat bigger than you would have thought based upon everyday experience, that there may be other universes out there. But we are not saying that anything can happen. That would not be a theory of physics. That would be simply a capitulation and saying, oh yeah, let's just say anything can happen. And that is a far cry from what we actually are doing. Having said that, talking about the theological issue, I don't think that what we're doing rules out the possibility of there being some divine being behind it all. Personally, I don't think that there is. When I do my work, I don't see any evidence of it, nor do I feel the need to invoke that kind of idea. But there's no way for physics to say that there isn't some divine being behind it all that set up the universe, that set up the constants, that set up the laws of physics. It's hard to rule out that idea. You know, it's hard to rule out many ideas, but that's one that people do take seriously for a variety of reasons. And I don't think it's responsible when physicists say we've now ruled out God, which I do hear now and then. Basically, we are ruling out any application of God that is meant to fill in the gaps in our understanding of how the physical world works. As we understand the world better, we need God to fill in those gaps less and less. God gets squeezed out as science gets ever more broad in the things that it can explain. But that doesn't mean that behind it all, there can't be a divine being. I don't see the need for it, but we don't rule it out.
Now, Andy's telling me we have to wind up, but I can't let you go without asking one more question. Sorry, Andy. It's just that I've got a professor of physics here, and I've never understood holographic universes, and he's probably the only one to explain it to me. So what is a holographic universe?
Well, this is, in my view, the strangest multiverse proposal.
Agreed.
Of all.
I've read this so many times, I still don't understand it.
So the possibility that actually comes out of black hole physics and string theory is that all we see in the world around us may be like a hologram. It may be a three-dimensional incarnation of laws of physics and processes that actually take place on a thin two-dimensional surface that surrounds us.
So we're a projection.
We are projections in that sense. Just like if you take a real hologram, it's a piece of plastic, you illuminate it correctly, it creates a realistic three-dimensional image. Now, where in the world would this idea come from? It comes from studying black holes. If you have a black hole and you throw something into the black hole, it disappears. The question is, where does the information that that object contains go? Imagine you throw the Encyclopedia Britannica or your iPad into a black hole, where does the information go? Now, the first thought is, well, it's gone. It's disappeared. It's inside the black hole. The problem is the laws of quantum physics don't allow information to simply disappear. So there's a tension. Quantum physics demands the information still be there. Black hole physics says it's gone. Who's right? Well, people like Gerard de Tooft, Nobel laureate in Holland, people like Leonard Susskind and Stanford, they say, when an object falls into a black hole, the information it contains, actually a copy of the information gets smeared on the outside of the black hole. And the math supports this. So you've got information on the outside of the black hole that describes the three-dimensional object that fell in. Now, what's true for black holes could be true for us. We are the three-dimensional object on the inside, and there can be information on this thin two-dimensional surface that surrounds us that's adequate to describe everything in our three-dimensional reality. In fact, that information on the surface, it seems, is more fundamental than the information that we are aware of. In that sense, everything that we do, everything that we see, everything that we think is actually a manifestation of processes and information processing happening on that distant surface. We are the holograms.
In that metaphor, then, we're the holograms inside, and the black hole is where we are.
Yes, exactly. Precisely right.
And how far away is this membrane?
That's a very hard question to answer, and that's part of what people are struggling with today. Roughly, I want to say at the edge of the universe, but if the universe goes on infinitely far and some of the things that we discussed, it's hard to know exactly what that means, but that is where the research right now is taking us, to try to apply these ideas to a more realistic universe like ours. Much of the math has been undertaken in hypothetical universes that have somewhat different shapes where that question is more easily answered. The next step, try to apply it to a universe just like ours.
And would this universe, this surface, as it were, it wouldn't be a two-dimensional M&M type shell around?
Sort of it is, but it's not a shell that you could punch or that you could crack the way you could for an M&M shell, but it would be a surface that would be a specific location in space.
But it's multi-dimensional, I'm assuming, is it?
Or two-dimensional. If we're talking
simple
about our three-dimensional reality. Yeah.
Interesting. I'm not sure I understand it any further, but there you go. Thank you very much. Thanks, Brian.
Thank
That's been really great. That just confuses me more, I tell you. Brian's book, The Hidden Reality, Parallel Worlds and the Deep Laws of the Cosmos, is out now. Follow this podcast on Twitter, @ScienceWeekly, and we'll let you know every time a new podcast is launched. And for the rest of the Guardian Science content, just follow Guardian Science. Next, we're going to head downstairs to the second floor of the Guardian, to the science desk, in fact, where producer Andy is eavesdropping on one of our live web chats.
Science Weekly from guardian.co.uk with Alok Jha.
That button there. And then you just paste in the URL, Apple V, and hit OK. Yeah. And that will hypertext it.
Great. Hi, I'm Tim Jackson. I'm sitting here on the science desk at the Guardian. I'm a professor at the University of Surrey and author of a book called Prosperity Without Growth. And why am I sitting here? Because we're engaged in a live Q&A on the question, is rampant consumerism ruining our lives?
Oh, you want a link to the comment or to them? You need that one.
So before we start the Q&A, kind of just give us a summary of your book and what kind of questions you expect from readers and listeners.
So the book asks critical questions about the economic growth model that we live under, and which came, of course, under severe shock a couple of years ago with the financial crisis and the recession. And it's not just about the recession, though. It's about asking whether an economy that grows forever can really deliver the needs of 7 billion people, soon to be 9 billion people on a finite planet. Can we really expect this consumerist lifestyle to go on and on, not just for us, but for everyone else in the world? And it's interesting because what it seems to be doing is provoking questions in all sorts of areas. Some of them are, the nitty-gritty of macroeconomics, and some of them are about who we are, what we want, what we need, what kind of people we are, and even some philosophical and religious takes on that. So it's a fascinating territory, and I'm kind of looking forward to engaging with questions on it.
Right.
Okay, so you've got an hour of questions coming up now.
Are we ready to go?
Yes.
Okay, yeah, well, let's go live then.
And then put your reply.
Yeah.
and it'll be clear that you're replying to him or her.
Okay, quite a few questions have already come in. Let's pick up on this one here. It says, I have a cheeky, if rather obvious question. How do you square marketing your book, which you may want us to go out and buy for ourselves, with your philosophy? Interesting question, Tim.
I mean, it's kind of nice in a way that I have an answer prepared for this, because it's actually something that I've struggled with personally. You know, what am I doing here? Am I marketing a book? Am I telling people my thoughts? Am I communicating some ideas? And of course, I'm doing all of those things. And, you know, one of the things I could say is, well, yeah, don't go and buy it. Don't buy this book. That's a good marketing strategy. Go and get your library to buy it, for example, if you can keep your library open long enough. But actually, because I struggled with it, interestingly, one of the things I persuaded the publishers, and they were great about it actually, to dedicate some of the sales, the revenues from the book, to rainforest protection. So if you buy this book, you're not just learning about the new economy, you're also contributing to it. I still think it would be a lot better to keep our libraries open and to have books like this in them.
Sorry about the cynical question.
So what are you up to now, Tim?
Well, I've just picked up a comment from the Middle Way. Actually, he's asking two questions, really. One is whether growth can be decoupled from resource exploitation. And one of my arguments in the book is, of course, it must be. But can we just get away with decoupling? And he's asking, you know, he's saying, actually, most people in the government assume that we can just decouple economic growth from resource extraction and let's keep growth going. And that's actually a really interesting argument, because it raises all sorts of questions about why government in particular thinks that we must keep growth going. In fact, they, you know, they absolutely don't want anyone to ask any questions of economic growth. And it's you know, complicated. There's all sorts of structural reasons why politicians, policymakers won't question growth. But there's also some pretty simple ones as well. Is that economic growth is how we keep economic stability, and governments have a role to protect economic stability. So, in some senses, they're doing their job. But in other senses, they're not, because we still haven't solved the problem that economic growth can't go on forever.
So just looking through some of the more recent entries here, there seems to be a Buddhism theme developing. Why has that come up?
Yeah, actually, it came up straight away. And I think it came up because the way the article is framed around, asking the question about rampant consumerism, it was really asking us, you know, what it is that makes us happy. Is it loads and loads of stuff, or is it our relationship to our friends, our family, our community, our sense of a meaningful life? And of course, many philosophical traditions ask those kinds of questions. And I think, actually, there has been, you know, a really interesting thread through Buddhism in particular, which asks that sort of question about what it means to be a human being, what it means to do well in a human life. And of course, they don't have the unique copyright over those kinds of ideas. But it was a thread that's actually been very, very active in the replies to the piece, in the comments. So that's fascinating. I shall write a few things about that.
A question here from Fommelhort88, interesting name. He basically asks, why are we mourning growth?
Yeah, he's asking me why I'm mourning growth, because he thinks growth is a good thing. And he thinks it's a good thing because it's delivered us lots of fantastic advances in Western society. In some sense, he's right, and I don't have a problem accepting that growth has brought us lots of things. And, you know, better health, more food, longer lives. Those are all, to some extent, real advances in human development. And I think we should accept that, and we should also accept that the poorest nations in the world desperately need those kinds of advances. But that doesn't get us off the hook. It doesn't actually answer those difficult questions. Can the planet really afford consumerist lives? Can the economy really continue working in that way? And when you keep coming up against no, the planet can't afford it. The economy won't work in that way. And it's some of it, at least, is not making us very happy. Yeah, that's the point, to start asking deep questions about the kind of economics we've got, the kind of system we've got, and the kind of society that we want. And that's really the goal of the book, to open those questions up.
Is there a way of finding the ones that I want to go back to?
Your book, Prosperity Without Growth, is now out in paperback, and it's got a new foreword by the Prince of Wales. I've been told to tease you about that.
Yes, HRH actually has been a surprising fan of the ideas, but surprising in some way, because he's obviously a very establishment figure, but not surprising in others, because he is someone who has taken a genuine interest in the environment, in the economy, in the way that the economy works. He's done masses in relation to bringing businesses on board in terms of understanding their environmental commitments, and actually a lot of his charity work, protection of the rainforests, the business charities, are all actually very much in line with the kind of messages in this book. So, of course, you know, you can ask, well, it's fine, he can sit there in Clarence House, you know, talking about economics from a position of comfort. But actually, this is a real man with real ideas and a lot of, I think, very valuable contributions to environmental debates.
All right, thanks, Tim. I think that just about wraps it up.
Yeah, thanks.
Your keyboard is smoking.
You can check out the whole of that web chat. Find it at environmentguardian.co.uk. The link's on our blog. Make sure you subscribe to this podcast so that every programme gets automatically delivered to your MP3 player. Head to our blog at guardian.co.uk/scienceweekly. Well, that's it for this week. Thanks to Brian Green and Tim Jackson. Brian's book, The Hidden Reality, Parallel Worlds and the Deep Laws of the Cosmos, is out now. Tim's book, Prosperity Without Growth, is out in paperback. He's also leading a discussion called Prosperity in the Future of Business on the 30th of March at the Shell Centre in London. If you're still thirsty for more juicy podcast goodness, make sure you listen to last week's Germany special, where we've explored some of the best research that country's doing. It's like going on a school field trip, but without the long bus journey. There are also four videos we made while we were there, including a fascinating microgravity experiment. Links are, as ever, on our blog. Next week, we've only bowed to popular demand and gone and organised a math special with Ian Stewart and Richard Elwes.
Yeah, actually, if you're having a math special next week, here's a question. Can anybody find a classification for all Calabi-Yau manifolds? These are complex Kalman manifolds of vanishing first Chern class. A classification of all Calabi-Yau manifolds. These are the extra dimensions in string theory of every possible dimension. I'd love to have an answer to that. I'll listen in next week to hear the answer.
This is your chance to pose some tricky questions to the experts. So send us in some sums. We may even allow calculators into the exam. Post them anywhere you want, on the blog, Facebook, or on Twitter. We'll find them. Don't forget to add your voice to our debate at guardian.co.uk/scienceweekly. That's where our wondrous archive lives, all free, of course. Almost 5 years of peer-reviewed podcast heaven. I reckon that's more than 100 hours of stuff that's almost guaranteed to make you more intelligent. This podcast was produced by Andy Duckworth. I'm Alok Jha. Thanks for listening.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.